Okay, I'm Rick Hansen. This is December 17th, 2014. And I was on retreat last week. In a sense, I helped teach a retreat, a meditation retreat at Spur Rock Meditation Center. And, you know, some reflections and experiences from that retreat I'd like to share with you fairly briefly, and then, you know, open it up to see what others have to say. And, you know, also kind of open it up for general questions, if that interests you. And the way in here to this topic, which I want to talk about craving and enoughness. And I don't think I mentioned this story. I sent it out as a link in my Just One Thing newsletter. Essentially, when the Dalai Lama came to America, I think toward the middle 80s, he wasn't famous yet in a big way. And there was a visit that was arranged for him, I believe, around in New Mexico, roughly. And so this young man somehow was just brought in to handle media and tour and everything like that. So he got to hang out with the Dalai Lama and his entourage for, I guess, a couple of weeks, 10 days or so, going around. And one of the places they went to was a ski resort. So they go up to the ski resort, and they described all kinds of very comical things that happened. You know, the chairlift, and this was an old chairlift, so there were no safety bars, and the Dalai Lama was sitting right next to this guy, and the Dalai Lama kept leaning out to, like, look down. Oh, my goodness! And the guy was so afraid. Oh, my God, the Dalai Lama is tumbling out of this chairlift. He's going to die. It's going to be on me, you know, the karma. Anyway, literally, they have these weird shoes. They're monks in their robes, but they're wearing basically wingtip, flat-soled shoes. So they get out on the snow, and they're like all like that, and they ended up falling over and getting knocked down. Anyway, all kinds of crazy stuff happened. So the long and short of the story that I want to get to is they were then at one of these little lodges getting some food, and a waitress was serving them, and very kind of a regular person, you know, not involved at all in Buddhism, but she recognized, oh, this was some kind of important person, monk, you know, what's up? And so she said to him, here's her question, she said, can I ask you a question? And he said, sure. And she said, what's the meaning of life? And of course, the guys writing the story say, we all had been wanting to ask the Dalai Lama that question, but we thought it was so uncool. That's that, you know, the meaning of life, they were all afraid to. So everybody in the room just whoop, stops, and they're all listening. And he laughs. He says, huh, the answer to that is simple. The meaning of life is happiness, obviously in a wholesome, broad sense. The meaning of life is happiness, but that's not really, that's an easy question. The important question, the hard question, is how to have that happiness and keep that happiness. That's the really interesting question. And that's the essence of the story, right? And so 2,500 years ago, the Buddha taught about this question. What is true happiness? What is lasting happiness? What is that false happiness that we chase after, making ourselves unhappier in the process, and others as well? And what does it take? What do we do to have that lasting happiness that our heart really, really longs for ourselves and for anyone else we would ever care about? And what the Buddha really focused on, in a word, was craving. And that word's a key word. Its root in language is thirst. You can feel it. It's a drive state in modern language, based on an underlying presumption of deficit or disturbance. Okay. And there are three kinds of craving, as the Buddha taught. There's the craving for, as he put it, sensual pleasure, which includes the absence of pain. We want the pain to go away. We want the noise to go away when we're seeking some kind of greater quiet. We want to have physical pleasures. We want to have subtle emotional pleasures, like feeling approved of. That's the first kind of craving. The second kind of craving is the really interesting one. It's the one I want to talk about tonight. The craving for becoming. Now, some of that's fairly, kind of gross, or, you know, it's like becoming important, becoming there instead of here, becoming dry instead of wet. But you can also observe a kind of subtle sense of unsatisfactoriness of the present moment and a desire for it to become something else, even when the present moment is perfectly fine. And that's I'm going to come back to that. And then the third kind of craving being, as he puts it, craving for not being, non-existence, the end, particularly in ways that are problematic, suicide, death, things ending. And let's just blow it all up. That as an aspect of that as well. So the craving for pleasure and the craving for the ending of pain is pretty straightforward. But what is this craving? And he's talking psychologically. He's saying, he's inviting us to look into our own experience, see for ourselves, what is this? Craving for becoming. Right? And he also says that the highest worldly sensual pleasures, the greatest sensual pleasures in the world, and the greatest pleasures in heaven are not worth 1/16th of the bliss of the ending of craving. That's a context here. Now, I have no idea if it's exactly 1/256th of the bliss of the ending of craving, but, it's kind of in the ballpark, maybe. So, what is that? And you can feel it. Like, there you are, you're just sitting, and there's a kind of subtle tension or pressure for, like, the next thing, or something else. Gimme. Want it. And if you think about it, in terms of just pure biology, it really makes a lot of sense. I mean, sometimes we look at what we are and then we can make up a story about why it was evolutionarily advantageous to become that. We have to be a little skeptical of those stories. Okay. It's not like you can run a control group on evolution. On the other hand, you can kind of see the ways in which if you were going to design animals that would scratch and claw and do whatever it took today to live to see the sunrise, to pass on genes, and to help their genes pass on genes, you would design them to crave becoming, to have a kind of uneasiness, an unsettledness, an unsatisfiedness, in kind of hardwired almost into the experience of any single moment, to keep them always looking, always tracking threats or looking for opportunities, or feeling what's going on in the interpersonal field, especially the more social animal they are, you would design them to have this kind of craving for becoming. So here we have this craving for becoming. And while it may have its very significant biological function, a fair question is, in more sophisticated animals, can we still pass on genes that pass on genes without the stress and the suffering and the trouble that comes from this craving for becoming? Also, even if that craving for becoming is in us, kind of innate, what's our relationship to it? Are we unconsciously caught by it? Do we presume it? Are we troubled by it and trying to fight it? Or in some way, can we be at peace with it through recognizing it and not being so entangled in it? You can feel it. You can feel it right now. Come on, Rick, get going, right? Or whatever else. And I can feel it in myself. And so one of the great things that you can recognize when you kind of become mindful of craving, you think of, what are we mindful of? Mindfulness of craving, including its subtleties, is extremely, extremely helpful. So one of the things that you start to recognize it is true, is that there's craving without a cause. Right? In an ultimate sense, there's a cause, evolution, biological nature, okay, fine. But in the moment, there's nothing missing in the moment. There's no actual threat in the moment. There's nothing left out in terms of basic needs. Everything's fine interpersonally, nothing to do in this moment. And yet craving is looking for a reason for being. Craving is looking for something to crave, right? You can kind of feel the automaticness of it, the baseless auto-craving. Just, and in addition to that insight, one thing that really helps undo or kind of defuel this craving that does create tension and it makes us uneasy and stressed and always kind of off balance. One way to undo it is to feel the enoughness of your moment, this moment, including you being enough as you are. And I think so much of the fuel that kind of drives this auto-craving and also what it grabs is that background felt sense that somehow as a person, you know, as Rick, as Tarnay, as Bill, as whoever, that somehow I'm just not enough as I am. You can kind of feel that. And so then because we don't feel like we're enough, we look for stuff, proofs of being enough, supplies that would somehow fill that hole in our heart. And I really invite you into a kind of feeling, an exploration of, huh, what is this quality of tension, stretching, when there's plenty already? And what would it be like to, you know, just kind of right now, just have the, open the door to the experience of, wow, I'm actually enough as I am. On this retreat, I had personally a kind of, you know, further step of feeling enough for myself. It was really valuable for me. It was very touching. And you, in your history, you might think of the ways you've been, in a sense, trained to not feel like you're enough. Just things that happen in your family, you know, at school, people more able, could run faster, read better, whatever. People didn't want, you wanted them, but they wanted her or him instead of you. Not enough. Job situations. And what is it really like to go, you know, to kind of open to, okay, I'm still developing and all that, but in a fundamental sense, I'm actually enough as I am. And as we approach the end of the year, I really wonder if you might, you know, as this time of gift giving, prioritize giving yourself the gift of feeling like you're enough as you are. Wrinkled, crummy credit, stuck with the person you're living with. Well, you know, whatever, you're not even just making it up here, but just that you're actually enough as you are. It's really quite something. For myself, as a detail that might be relevant to people, I realized that in early childhood, it's natural to get the experience, and it's actually healthy to get the experience, you know, 0 to 3, 0 to 5-ish, maybe a little longer, that, you know, that kind of experience parents and teachers sometimes and others have to give to kids, like, oh my goodness, you're the most amazing, you know, Play-Doh maker in the world, right? Or, oh, that was the most beautiful painting in second grade, honey. Right? And you feel it, like, oh my God, I'm so amazing. And, right? And that's healthy to feel that. But then you go out into the playground and the other kids, like, psh, they could care less. Or you go out into life in general and, you know, into adulthood and you just, it's hard to get that experience. And so we might perhaps long for sort of like big experiences, and absent them, we feel like we're not enough somehow. And for me, there was like a kind of clarity about that and a letting go around that. And real, like, what the heck? I'm enough as I am, warts and all. And so, okay. So that's the thrust, really, that I want to talk about tonight and see what you make of it. See if there's anything else you want to talk about. You know, what's the feeling of craving, right, including subtle? And we're using that word craving loosely, not so much I want to get a heroin fix right now, but sort of like stretching for the next thing, especially becoming, craving for becoming. And what's the undoing of it, of like playing around with feeling, for example, utterly all right now, or feeling already entirely satisfied right now, or feeling already loved enough right now, and now and now and now. What happens then? And what's it like to live on the basis of that, and to try to train the mind and therefore the brain increasingly to be stable in that place as an opening and spreading? Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. What do you make of this? Yeah.
Yeah, Rick, I'm glad you came back to this topic. You mentioned it about a year and a half ago, and I was hoping you'd come back to it, because I come from a developmentalist background. And so I'm really interested if you have any more thoughts about, you touched on it briefly, talking about what I took as a healthy desire for development versus an unhealthy craving for being something other than who you are. And, you know, the healthy desire for development gets us into adulthood, gets us into, you know, further evolution as adults.
Yeah.
The unhealthy desire gets us into all sorts of other things. So I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, the way, if I translate what you said, if I got it right, it's poignant that we actually need certain experiences in young childhood, interpersonal experiences, that are, you know, of feeling really special and really important and unconditionally, no matter what a pill we are, you're still going to love me. Mm-hmm. It's like that beautiful book, makes me cry when I, not quite cry, but tear up when I think about it too much, The Runaway Bunny. You know, the little creature, the little bunny says, I'm going to turn into a fish and swim away. And the mama bunny says, yeah, but I'll turn into a whale and come get you. And, you know, I'm going to turn into a bird, a seagull, and fly away. Yeah, but I'm going to turn into an eagle and find you. You know, like, it's so important to feel sought, right? And then what do we do, though, when we're an adult and there's still a longing for that and a presumption of insufficiency or lack, deficit and disturbance, right? The engines of craving. When that's just not the case. That's what we're talking about. And I think there's a place in practice for looking for healthy versions of what was missing for us, healthy adult versions of what was missing for us in childhood. You know, looking for those opportunities to feel special, you know. I mean, I've had situations, honestly, where as a therapist or a person, it was really honest on my part, and it was really important for that other person to really kind of hold them in my eyes and say, really, you are special to me, and help them take it in. And I don't say this about me being anything, just there's that moment. It's healthy, right? So I think there is a place for that and internalizing that. And also, it's funny. It's like the third Zen patriarch has this funny line in this chunk of teaching that's come forward to us today, I'm sure over 1,000 years later. He says, enlightenment is no anxiety about imperfection. That's quite an extraordinary sentence. Every so often you read some of these people, these like saints or super illuminated beings, and you just go, I mean, WTF? Like, what? You know, and you kind of work backwards to what possible mind, heart, space, spirit could like come up with that, and that's what really where the action is. And so the thing is, this, in a sense, because all experience is fleeting, it's inherently unsatisfiable in a long-term way. We can't find lasting satisfaction in it. It doesn't mean that it's unsatisfactory, although that's sometimes a translation. It's just that it's incapable of satisfying us in a lasting and reliable way. In other words, it's imperfect in that sense. And if we don't get anxious about that, if we're more at peace about that fact, we're not disturbed by living. Yes, incapable of lasting satisfaction, and yes, you know. And also if we come to peace with the ways in which adult relationships just aren't going to give us the supplies that we longed for, or they're not going to repeat those fantastic million-dollar moments we got, you know. You know, it's just, sorry, it's not going to happen, you know. Someone starts doing that at you, it's like, whoa, that's a little weird. Get off me. Right? So that's, and I think, so that's it. And yeah.
I think your point is something that matches my experience. I think it seems to relate to what the kind of form that the core wounding took. Like myself, there was like being outcast by a crowd. And so when I was able to work in healing the wound and feel appreciated by like a group I was teaching,
yeah.
It touched at some deep place. So I think there's something about mirroring, I don't have all the right language from psychology, but there's something about mirroring back in ways that your mirroring was wounded. Like you talked about being really appreciated and but being like rejected by the tribe, which is a deep instinct, having that mirrored in a positive way can really heal that. I saw for myself that that craving was just trying to fill that deficiency of that wound.
Yeah.
And so when those wounds can get healed by positive reinforcement, the craving has gone way down. Like I don't crave sugar the same way.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it really seems to be related.
Yeah, well, you're if I follow you right, your example is very much one of repeatedly, in my language, taking in the good, repeatedly internalizing these key experiences, in your case, feeling included, mm-hmm. an experience I very much relate to as important,
belonging.
And lacking, belonging, being wanted, part of the, you know, and all that. Anyway, you repeatedly internalize it, and there's less longing for it, and probably less longing in general. And, you know, different words might work for you, but if you think about it, a lot of what practice is about is stabilizing, you know, kind of expanding and stabilizing, you know, as a development, is more and more over time, expanding and stabilizing the sense of ongoing enoughness. And it's really quite interesting to explore it. Like, what's it like to just sustain that? And you can watch how quickly it crumbles, and you start learning. It's almost like a body learning, like how to kind of have it be more and more stabilized. Ongoing enoughness. It's really interesting. You feel it almost in your body. Like, what's the posture of ongoing enoughness? What's the embodiment? What's that feel like? What's your face look like? How are you interpersonally when you're with someone and there's a sustained interpersonal sense of enoughness and okayness? And you're like still interacting, but there's enoughness and okayness. And like, I'm loved enough already while we talk here. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, please.
I love what Bill said before about, you know, what do we do with this, all this, even if we don't do anything. And my own personal craving that comes up a lot here is how to apply it.
Yeah.
And I work in a context of working with kids and adolescents in a psychiatric setting, and a lot of them have not had the, oh, you're so cute,
yeah.
experience. And we were talking about this week in the context of the difference between self-esteem and self-compassion. Mm. And a lot of the kids, what it was hitting me is that a lot of the kids keep trying to do stuff to get that feeling, but it's never really about them. It's what can I do to convince people that I'm valuable? And I was talking with them about, you know, how do you get the sense that you are enough? And they had no idea what I was talking about. You know, it brought tears to my eyes. Like, I choked up just even thinking about it. And so what I struggle with is this idea of how to help these adolescents mostly just come up with that feeling that they've never had before. And I can give it to them briefly in the few days that their insurance lets them stay in the hospital. But it's so fleeting and so painful to work to sit with these kids who just don't know what this could be like. So this is my own personal craving and putting this all together and trying to bring it back to my work.
Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, it's, you know, how do we help people who haven't felt like they're enough or anything at all even? Start to feel that, and that would be a whole thing, and I've thought a lot about it. I'll just say really quickly, if you look back, what's the famous line, what, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny? In other words, the development of the embryo recapitulates evolution. Well, if you work backwards, this wound happened in, because there wasn't enough normal developmental experiences. And you know, the term in psychoanalysis, in a way, is the corrective emotional experience. So that's what we offer. Okay, you know that. So then I think about what's helpful is to appreciate that there are a lot of little building blocks that are within reach. Like, okay, complete self-worth and self-acceptance, that's a stretch. But feeling included, that's accessible. I can work with that experience, right? Or feeling what it's like in me to recognize the worth in you. And as I do that, I know what that experience is like, and I know there had to be some feeling of worth, that it's worthy in me that I can recognize the worth in you, for example. And we just start, as I'm sure you do, and I think it's really important to appreciate the power of these little building blocks and to not overlook them. And I don't know about you, but in my own, craving for becoming, I would often tend to skip over these building blocks. They weren't very glamorous, or they were kind of boring, or I wasn't very impressive when I focused on them, just because they were fairly obvious and mundane. But really working it. Work the foundation, you know, and then the building goes up. So I think that part's important. And I think also it's a funny thing to access. But it's a very interesting thing to talk about, and you may have a sense of it in yourself right now. I've often wondered about exploring this as a Dharma topic, the kind of will to survive, the will to live, to get through, to, you know, I think of it as feral, like the hawk. It's not personal, but the hawk wants the bunny, right? And the bunny wants to get away from the hawk, even though getting away from the hawk will starve the hawk. And I don't know about you, but you know, I have a lot of access to that quality, and it got me through my childhood in a lot of ways. It got me through other situations too, just that intense, almost animal will to just, if nothing else, get through this horrible situation, you know, just stay alive. And I do think that there's a way to have people tap that as an aspect of self-worth. And it's accessible. Like the urge to take the next breath. I will take the next breath. If you grab me, I will try to get out. You know, if I recognize that you're a jerk, you know, and kind of coming at me, I will stay quiet if I need to get out of this situation. You know, I will. That feeling. And it's very interesting to explore that from a Buddhist perspective, because it's right close at craving. But how do we use it and, you know, make use of it? So isn't that an interesting inquiry? It's like a dirty little secret, you know. The Buddhist will to survive, not an oxymoron. Anyway, right? Well, a couple more, Linda, or maybe just one more. Yeah, Linda.
So I'm following everything you're saying about the healing of the developmental trauma deficit disturbance. My experience of having this abundant enoughness is as soon as that's real, the sense of self falls away. It's not needed. And so in some sense, the crumbling and the falling back into the craving of becoming is the reassertion of the self and the fears or needs of the self. And coming to that sense of enoughness dissolves itself. That's part of the liberation of it.
Yeah, thank you. You know, and you can see as well, as you know, that we think often that the self is what is a major source of craving, wanting, but you can also just watch your mind. Kind of relaxed, not much sense of self, not much sense of wanting. Wanting arises because you think of something or something happens that's really pleasant, or it could be pleasant if you could get it, or it is unpleasant or would be unpleasant if you fail to avoid it. So, right, so then what happens? Contact, chain of dependent origination, you know, right, stimulus. There's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Then there's craving. Then selfing follows. Wanting starts building a self. Did you ever watch that? there you are, your mind's pretty mellow. Suddenly you find there's a wanting, and then one or two or three seconds later, there's more and more sense of me, myself, and I present. So it can get a go both ways. You know, self falls away, craving can fall away. Craving falls away, self falls away, right? That was very powerful and useful for me to watch the ways in which the sense of self rose and fell as a means to the end of craving, of wanting. But I really want to just go back experientially, if I could, you know, because it can get very complex. I thought, you know, recognize complexity, practice simplicity. Right? Practice of simplicity. What's the simplicity, the experience of, like, feeling disturbed, deficit, subtly agitated, reaching? Reaching is the craving for becoming. What is that? Even when there's no basis for it. What's that feel like? And then what's it feel like to just feel, you know, that enoughness, right? Just sustained enoughness. What's that feel like? And can you explore that edge in your own experience? Huh? Bill?
Just a slightly different way of expressing that comes to my mind.
Uh-huh.
And that is that it's inevitable that there will be the next moment. And whether we are craving it or anything, it's going to happen. And we can fall into that occasionally. And these things drop away, as has been expressed in different ways by Linda and you. It's just a little different way. I've had that.
Yeah.
And a couple of other things. This is really interesting about the difference between self-esteem and self what's the other one?
Compassion.
Well, yeah, it's too much to get into. But I want to just say something. A few in this room know this. And I want to know, you asked us, so we can ask questions about anything. So we got 30 seconds left.
That's right.
I'd like to know, having a little grandson, how would a very, you know, accomplished Buddhist practitioner interact with that little child? Would he do these things that you've just enacted here or not? I mean, we want to do that because we see this miracle arising in front of us. And we're so effusive with our enthusiasm for having witnessed this miracle. We want to do that. And yet, it may backfire if this little kid gets too much of that. And I did get that as a child. I had a very severe disease, and most of my parents' friends thought I might wind up in an iron lung for the rest of my life. They're scared as hell. Well, I didn't get that. I recovered fully. But for the rest of my childhood, teenage years, when I would see all my parents' friends, they would want to see me. Let me see you. They'd hug me, they'd weep, and I didn't know what that was all about. I got the message, though, that I was some kind of a miracle child. But it's a serious point I'm making.
Yeah.
It may sound humorous. And mm-hmm. I came out fairly favorable, except I wound up discovering, oh yeah, I'm not a miracle child after all. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of tough for me. So these things can backfire. And all of that went on, I mean, I just grew up with that understanding that people would see me and they'd just about fall apart and weep with happiness. It didn't happen for my sister. She didn't. She announced the band, you know.
Yeah. Just another
interesting.
Yeah. So briefly, what do we do with young children or each other to, on the one hand, you know, do, especially again, it's our nature to inhale, to breathe air. It's our nature to love and be loved. And if we don't breathe air, or if we don't love, or if we don't feel loved, that's against our nature, right? So how do we be with that in a way that doesn't, as it were, feed arrogance, conceit, or a craving for that rush of being of adulation that you got when you were 3 or 23, and they're not buying your book anymore, or whatever that might be, right? So, right? And I find that a deeply important and interesting question. And part of it, I feel, is very much about the internalization of these experiences so that cultivation undoes craving. So that because we receive them and we encourage our children to receive it, you know, there's less and less sense of deficit or disturbance inside, and less, therefore, trouble. So I think that's really one part. And then I'll just kind of leave you on this sense, if you like, where you have both a feeling for, like, the beauty of the other person, right? And also their transience. And one of the really beautiful edges is to have a feeling for, like I said, the beauty of that, what's happening over there, and also the sense that it's just part of a vast and larger whole. You know, the beauty in the other person, just a kind of transient local patterning of the allness that will soon disperse, like you. And on that happy thought, let's sit for a minute. I have a friend, a former abbot of a monastery, whose practice a lot is, to, as he puts it, to renounce expectations, including literally the expectation that the next second will occur. I mean, he's at that edge in his practice. And that's an interesting exploration that's very relevant to what we've talked about tonight. He hopes for the next second for himself and those he loves, but he renounces expectations. Thank you very much. I truly feel grateful to you. May you be truly happy.